Hello, everyone. Welcome to San Antonio. I'm Pete. I'm an alcoholic. And they told me everything was bigger in Texas. Man, this is big. It's overwhelming. We don't get these size of rooms back home. Anyhow, I'll start the meeting. Anybody that's here that wants to use the assisted listening, tune to channel 89.5. There's been a minor change, so please don't tune to 88.1. I think it's opera music. Or something like that. I'd like to start the meeting with a moment of silence. That we're all here today celebrating 75 years of AA, followed by the Serenity Prayer. May I have that moment, please? Now I'd like to introduce the topic. The topic is pain, the touchstone of growth. Now, we've all experienced pain. As for me, I went through a lot of pain when I was drinking, and the way I drowned my pain was I would get drunk and I thought all my problems and challenges would go away, and they never did. And in recovery, you know, this year I celebrated 25 years and I still experience challenges and pain. I was diagnosed with cancer and I survived. I'm here. Two of my close friends in AA back home died in the last 6 months of cancer. But you know what? They didn't drink. They didn't have to pick up a drink to face their pain in sobriety. So we all go through pain. And what I'm trying to relay here is that through the grace of God and this program, I have choices. I don't have to pick up that drink. I could deal with life on life's terms and handle situations that used to baffle me. To me, that's the difference today in my recovery. And it's thanks to AA and all the people that I meet in AA that are there to help me. So that's enough about me, because I'm not the main speaker here. There's three speakers. We're spoiled. The three speakers are Paul from Ontario, Canada. Zazu from Galveston, Texas. And finally, but not least, Charles from Braxton, Mississippi. Now, these three individuals are going to share, and I'm going to be the timekeeper because, you know, as you all know, there's other meetings that go on in this room. And so they're each going to share roughly for about 20 minutes on the topic of pain, the threshold, the touchstone to growth. And we'll start first to my right with Paul. So I'd like to introduce Paul.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul D., and I am an alcoholic. I'm from Ottawa, Canada. And I'd just like you to know that I'm a little bit nervous. I prepared a fantastic talk for you last night. I went to bed early and I slept about 2 hours, and the rest of the night I was preparing my talk. The only problem is that I forgot 95% of it. So I've got about 5% of getting nervous and preparing to do my job here this morning. I put down a few notes. I don't usually do that, but I must share with you, in Ottawa, we have our big meetings are about 100, 150, and in my years of sobriety, oh, by the way, my date of sobriety is July 6, 1986, so on Tuesday I'll be celebrating 24 years. And that's a miracle. And the other miracle is that I'm standing here in front of, 600-700 people speaking. If you had told me that 24 years ago, I would have said, no way. Try to share my experience, strength, and hope. And usually when I speak, I like to break up my story in three parts. From birth to about the age of 15, when I picked up my first drink, I was brought up in an alcoholic home. So I experienced a lot of pain, and pain in different ways, not always with the definition of pain. I think of fear, anxiety, low self-esteem, depression, all kinds of negative emotions. My house was like the Grand Central Station. Everybody drank. My father was an alcoholic, and my mom, after a while, she said, well, if you can't beat him, join him. So she started drinking. And then my older brother started joining my dad when he was about 13, 14. And then what I remember from 0 to 15 is being very fearful, low self-esteem. I remember laying in bed, 9, 10 years old. And the fight was on with mom and dad, and he was bouncing her off the walls, and my brother would get in the mix, and then I was like 9 and 10 and just shaking and saying, I'll never drink, and when I grow up, I'll beat up my dad, and blah, blah, blah. All the good stuff that goes with an alcoholic home. Another part of my upbringing that I think about pain is I would never want to bring any of my friends home, because I never knew what kind of shenanigans would be going on. My friend's home seemed much more stable, more normal. So I tried to keep my friends away from bringing them home. So I spent a lot of time at their house. One incident that I thought of just last night, and it happened probably around over 40 years ago. I remember driving around in my project, where I lived, on my bike with a few guys, and all of a sudden people started saying, "There's a big accident on the corner there. A guy cut an 18-wheeler, and he was hit." And my dad had just had a heart attack, and he wasn't supposed to drink, but he stopped at the hotel for a few, and with his medication, he got out of there, and he only had about a block on the main drag to turn into our area, and he cut in front of an 18-wheeler, and he had a 19, it's probably in 70, 72, he had a big Dodge Monaco, I remember. And the big 318 motor was right beside him on the front seat. And he had about 50 stitches. He had broken ribs and broken leg. And I just remember getting close enough to see who it was. And he got out of the car, and he was swinging, fighting with the cops. And the shame and the pain, because my friends knew it was my dad. And I realized just last night that probably the normal thing to do would have been for me to run to the car and see how my dad was, but I didn't. I turned around and I went home. So I relate that to pain. And with all this, and there's many more incidences, around the age of 14, maybe I should explain a little bit how I felt about myself. I remember my aunts and coming over and always saying, mon beau Paul, you cute little Paul. And there was a little voice in the back said, bullshit, I'm ugly. Very low self-esteem. I was bullshit, I'm ugly. My brother was born in 51. I was born in 56. So when my mother introduced us, she'd say, my son number one. And my son number two. But what I heard is the second best was, that was me. So I had a lot of hang-ups. When I looked in the mirror, I saw a big nose, I saw big ears, I was too skinny, I was too this, too that. So very shy, very insecure. And then, lo and behold, one night, 14, 15, we're at a party, and I drank maybe, I don't know if I drank the whole quart, but I passed out or blacked out, but the next day I remembered that all those negative feelings about myself weren't only zapped, that I felt even better than everybody else. So from that day on, my goal was to get drunk and stay drunk as much as I could. And I didn't drink for many years. I drank for about 15. I came to the program just a few months before turning 30. And
just have a bit of water.
So alcohol took away a lot of the pain. The problem with that happened to me is that when I started drinking, I could get drunk on probably 3 or 4 beers. And the more I practiced, I got better at it. And my capacity for drinking got higher, of course. And then by the end of my drinking, I had so much alcohol in me that, yeah, I still started getting a buzz at 3 or 4 beers. But the amount of drinking and what I drank was, I could mix any kind of hard liquor with beer, with wine, and I would never throw up. I would keep it, but I would get so sick. The hangovers were so bad, it would take me 2 or 3 days to stop shaking, rattling, and rolling. So what happened is, how I got the program is that one of my older sister married an alcoholic, and he joined the program in 1975, and he put on a wedding, and we all went to the wedding. And my brother and his wife, after this wedding, decided to sober up. And my brother-in-law said, if you stay sober for a year, I'll speak at your 1-year medallion. So they stayed sober, so me and the wife went to the 1-year medallion. I was very happy for my brother because he was dying. He had blood coming out both ends, and he couldn't eat anymore. He was just drinking. And I saw the power of example in them. They did it. They were getting healthy. They were getting, their life was getting straightened. But it wasn't for me. I wasn't that bad. So when we went to this 1-year medallion, my wife was sitting beside me, and lo and behold, my brother-in-law was speaking, and he spoke about drinking and drugs, and I guess she identified, and I could hear her sniffling and crying on her chair, and I said, oh, suck. What's going on here? He said, I want to stop drinking. I said, just shut up, and we'll go home after the meeting. Don't say nothing. Everything's fine. Don't get all emotional. But she, she wouldn't let go. No, I've had enough, this and that. So anyway, we went, they send us off to, I guess on a 12-step call, a few people who went to the restaurant. And anyway, she decides she wants to stop drinking. And in my alcoholic thinking, I'm starting to think, well, if by this time we'd buy 24, put it all in the fridge, and I'd drink about 6 or 7 each, and I'd start hiding some behind the salad bowls and the celery and stuff, because say, if she thinks there's none left, then she'll go to bed and I'll finish the rest of the 24. So my thinking was, well, I'll encourage her to stop drinking and I'll have more for me. And that's what I did for the first couple of weeks. I used to go to meetings and I'd say, hi, my name is Paul, my wife's an alcoholic. And I did that for a couple of weeks, and I guess the third week I finally heard my message. And I decided to pick up a desire chip. And I didn't even know it was, you know, meeting at Open Door. There was probably 150 people. And my dad's favorite sister was at that meeting with her husband. And she came and gave me a big hug and congratulated me and said, "I'm glad you're here because your dad never made it. At least you did." So that was the beginning of my sobriety. And that was almost 24 years ago. In sobriety, you know, it wasn't all hunky-dory. There was a lot of there's enough chaos in a family with one alcoholic, so imagine two. The thing that I was sharing with my buddies just yesterday, the thing that kept me in the program the first year, my son was born in 82. We joined the program in 86. So that's over 4 years of alcoholic drinking, you know, both as a couple. And what kept me coming back is the remembering the feeling, the pain, when we'd get up on the next morning of a big drunk. And first of all, I don't remember who drove. Second, I don't remember where the car is, if it's smashed up. And for those 4 years, did we bring the baby in? Now, a lot of nights, we live in Canada, and it's 20, 30, 40 below. And just remembering the jog from my room to the baby's room and looking in and seeing the baby, that's what kept me coming back. And wanting sobriety. You wanted what I had. By the time I came in, my brother-in-law had about, you know, 10, 11 years of sobriety, and they were doing good financially, and I had expectations. I said, well, stay sober 6 months to a year, and I'll be able to buy a fifth wheel and a boat and this and that. And that didn't happen. The wife that I sobered up with, I've separated from her. She's still out drinking. And I've met another lady. And it's not 100%. Life is not perfect, but we're still together. We're getting along. This year, I had the opportunity to go to Florida with visit my friend Pete. And I just happened to be lucky, and I got a mobile trailer in Florida that I can come go to every year. And while we were in Florida in this trailer, my wife got kidney stones, so we had to come back because the insurance didn't want to pay for the second operation. So I had to leave my car there. So I started looking for a used car just for the summer. And lo and behold, there's this BMW 77 Beamer just screaming at me to come and buy it. So, you know, life is good. It's not a new Beamer, but it's a lot of fun to drive. I don't know where I am in the time situation. 1 minute, wow, that's pretty close. Who's counting? Okay, well, I just wrote something down that I read in the 24-hour day book a couple of days ago that I'd like to close with, if you permit me. Learn daily the lesson of truth and calm in the midst of the storms of life. Whatever of sorrow or difficulty the day may bring, God's command to you is the same. Be grateful, humble, calm, loving to all people. Love each soul the better for having met you or heard you. I hope you feel better today for having listened to me. I know I feel better for speaking with you. My name is Paul. I am an alcoholic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, that's a nice way to kick off the conference, right? Next, we have Zazu. Now, give her a warm welcome. She's a little nervous, so.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Zazu, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date this time is June 29th, 1988, and for that I am truly grateful. Whew. I am nervous, but I always feel that that's keeping me sane and humble. I want to thank the General Service Board for allowing me to speak today. All I had to do was say I was willing. I am not an expert. I'm just a drunk. And I am grateful to know that there is a solution to all of my problems, even this nervousness. Whew. My home group is the New Day Group of Galveston, Texas. Woo! So if you happen to wander down to Galveston, go to 33rd and P at 7:30 in the morning, and you'll see some of us there. I never was a morning person until I moved to the beach. And there is nothing like waking up and going down to the beach. I am touched by the people that have come to share with me. From California, when I go out there to visit family, I have a temporary sponsor, and she sent some representatives to send her love to me. And the chain of sponsorship within Texas is here, and I am grateful for you all. So, someone once remarked that pain was the touchstone of all spiritual progress, for we know that the pains of drinking had to come before sobriety, and emotional turmoil before serenity. That's from the 12 and 12, page 93 and 94, which is in step 10. That is so true in my own life. When out there and drinking, I love the expression, and in my cups, I felt no pain. I don't know about you, but it was a long time before I felt that. It was joyful. It was happy. It was fun. I started drinking in 1967 at the age of 16. And I continued drinking. And I started out with brown liquor. And until I was thinking here, the pain that I've caused others, as well as the pain that I've caused myself. I was at a semi-family affair and called my mother a not good name. And later on in sobriety, I realized how much pain I had caused her. But being an alcoholic at that time, what did I do? I switched drinking brown liquors and went to the clear liquors. It made sense to me. The journey began drinking and traveling. I started in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And, I'm amazed, though, sometimes they get sober there. But isn't that the case wherever we come from, people really get sober? It was the highs and lows, the ups and downs of drinking and having that hangover and leftover, and you go, holy mackerel. Let me stop this roller coaster and move to something else. So I moved to Chicago. And I was drinking beer and wine because I went to Canada for a while and was turned on by their Canadian ales. Oh, I loved them. Never. I was really a winette. But went to Chicago, and there they were selling beers in gas stations. Pennsylvania, it's all liquor control, but not in Chicago. Gas stations, food stores. Well, if you weren't an alcoholic moving there, you certainly were the one living there. I always had something there. But I took a chance on life, a game of chance, and I lost my ambition while there. I went to Indiana and took another chance on a game of life and lost my self-respect. So what did I do? I moved to Florida. And there they do give you a six-pack with your driver's license. Woo! That was a fun place. But it was also there that I had hit my bottom. I would say I was only going to have one drink on the way home from work. And about 2 a.m, I'd wander out to the car and land up at some friend's house and sleep on their porch because they knew never to open the door past midnight. And then some mornings I would wake up in my own house wondering, how did I get there? But reaching for that warm glass of beer because the nerves were too much. And then I was living with a roommate, and she got word that her husband, who had been wandering around the country drinking and calling us from different states and different jails and different prisons, that he had been murdered. And I saw the similarities in my life with his. I saw that I was wandering around from state to state, drinking brown liquor, clear liquid, beer, wine. I was being detained by the police, but I had never been arrested yet. And I thought, I don't want to go down that path. I saw where it took him. That was my wake-up call. And 2 weeks later, I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had asked a friend of mine, what do I do? And he suggested I go there. So I went to a meeting in West Palm Beach, a women's meeting. I didn't want to go to a men's meeting because if you're drunk like me, you already know half of them anyway. Oof, this is a God deal. Thank you. So I did that, and then I asked my roommate if she would be, who would help me do the steps. The women in those meetings, I don't know, they seemed a little seedy to me. They had done some of the things I hadn't done yet. They had been to some places I hadn't been yet. And they certainly have done things that I hadn't done or wouldn't admit to. And that was more the case. So my roommate, of course, she said yes, she was a good, I always call her an Al-Anon. She was not in the Al-Anon program at all, but she could handle everything. So as we went through the steps, I left my inventory to her because she had a much better handle on pointing out my defects than I did. What God wanted to remove, that he would remove. He certainly didn't need my help, so I left that. And I certainly wasn't going to make amends to people I didn't even like or see anymore. I was always went by, you let sleeping dogs lie. Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? So I had stopped drinking then, and that was in March of 84. But, as you could tell, I hadn't changed my way of thinking. And I certainly hadn't changed much of my actions. All I had done was stop drinking. And if you're an alcoholic like me, the pain cannot be subsided unless you are drinking. And so, shortly thereafter, it wasn't so short, I thought, what do I have to do to stay, to take care of my life? I'm still sober, but I'm crazy. I start assuming a lot of things in my life is what God's going to be doing for me. I hadn't done any work yet. It was all God. So some man walked in front of me, and I said, that's the one. I'm going to marry him, and all my problems will be solved. Yeah, you all know what happened. Well, with that marriage, a lot of other things changed. I moved to Texas. Yay! I had a baby. Yay! And I didn't drink from 84 until 87. It was an insane marriage. It was based on fears and delusions that I was okay because I was not drinking. But I discovered the pain of that. And in early 1988, he disappeared with my 18-month-old daughter. And the pain came to a realization. The veils of delusion and denial fell to the ground, and I saw I was not well, that my life was as unmanageable today as the day it was when I first stopped drinking, because I hadn't been doing the steps. I did not know what I had been missing, but I knew I was in pain and I had to do something about it. So I called the central office and said, "Where's the closest meeting?" And they directed me there. And in June of 1988, I walked into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous, beaten, but willing to do whatever I needed to do to get out of the pain and to stay sober. Because I had drank again in March, and I didn't want to do that again. So I had ears, and I could hear you this time. You said, "Don't drink. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. Do the steps and keep coming back and do it again tomorrow." I heard that this time. Now I'm sure you said it when I was in Florida, but I didn't hear it. So I did that, and she helped me to see. All I had to do was be honest, open-minded, and willing. Some of the suggestions, I wasn't sure. I was still a little thinking. But experience being sober now with some directions from this woman who had a sponsor and who did the steps made a world of difference in my life. She had said I never had to drink again, and I never had to feel like that again. But I had to do it different. But I never had to do it alone either. I had her. She was showing me. She was helping me to get honest with myself, with my motives. So that was good. Life got real different then. Then it got better. Woo-wee. Repetition was essential to my recovery. I had to keep going back to meetings. Because if I forgot where I came from, if I forgot the pain of that dryness, then I probably would be back there again. So I kept going to meetings. She said, I don't know. I wrote notes, but I'm trying to just free myself and let you hear what is in my heart. By doing the steps, I got some wisdom to know the difference between temptations and the opportunities for wisdom. Because I was still tempted, I don't know about you, with some worldly things and flesh and stuff. But they said to put the spiritual first and the mental and physical would follow. That was a hard thing for me to practice. So I practiced it, though, because I didn't want to drink again and I didn't want to feel the pain again. However, I did get into a relationship in my first year. I know some people say not to do that, but I did. But it was good. And then God did for me, because the pain came again. I was about a year and a half sober in the program now. And this gentleman died. And I thought, oh my God, what do you do now? You go to a meeting, you don't drink, you share, keep doing the steps, and do it over again tomorrow. I never had to do it alone. I had to try to tell my daughter that this man died. And she was around maybe 3 at the time. That was a hard thing to do. But she and I cried together. I don't know her comprehension of it. We talk about it every once in a while. She vaguely remembers. Somewhere during all of that pain, I was asked to go if I wanted to help carry the message into the jails and prisons. And I said, well, I've never been arrested. And they said, how long you been sober? I said, 1.5 years, 2 years. They said, that's what they need to hear. They know how to drink. They know how to get arrested. They don't know how to stay sober through the pain. They only knew how to dull it. So I went into the jails, and for the last 20 years, that has anchored my sobriety. Whenever I think I have it rough, I go in there and know that at least God can control my actions, not TDCJ. And for that, I am grateful. I let them know that they don't have to do it alone. They don't have to drink anymore. And they don't have to feel like that anymore. But you have to do it different. And the answers to all my problems are in the big book. And by carrying the message into those jails and prisons, it keeps me real anchored into the book. Because I don't want to carry the mess. I want to carry the message of hope and of recovery. About 3 years sober, my ex, the divorce, I forgot to tell you, there was a divorce, but you all knew that. When you get married in denial and fear, of course there's a divorce. It was all final by this time, and he had custody of my daughter. And he disappeared. He moved. It's all perception, isn't it? But it was against the court orders, and he moved to California. And I didn't see my daughter for a little more than a year. But I knew that the God that I had come to understand loved even my ex. That always amazed me. And he loved my daughter. And I knew that all things would be okay if I just kept going to meetings, reading the big book, doing the steps, sharing it with others, and not drinking. So I just kept doing that. And then life got real better because I had faced my worst fears in that situation. And the worst fear for a mother, I walked through it with my sponsor, with ladies in recovery, and I didn't drink. And I kept coming back. I came to believe that all these events in my life were put there. It's all normal, ups and downs. You know, am I going to make it a mountain out of a molehill or see it for what it is? It's an opportunity to learn and to practice the spiritual principles given to me by practicing the steps over and over and over again in my life. Repetition is absolutely essential for me. I have a real bad memory. My perception gets screwed sometimes. But I also knew I never had to do any of these things alone. Each day, the pain of worldly temptations and wisdom come in many forms, presenting opportunities to me for spiritual growth. I can grow, or I can go. And I did not want to leave the fellowship that gave me a life worth remembering and worth living. I can grow in recognizing the cunning and baffling, powerful manifestations of its temptations. I can grow in practice of the solutions of recovery in all aspects of my life. My sponsor told me how to gather my facts, to go and pray and meditate about it, clean house, trust God, and work with others. My life has been touched by the grace of God, transforming the pain and suffering into humility, honesty, and a willingness to share the message that you never have to drink again. You never have to feel like that again. But you will have to do it different, and you never have to do it alone. God is always with us if we ask. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you, Zazu, for a great message. Our final speaker is Charles from Braxton, Mississippi.
Good morning. This is wonderful. I'm Charles Thompson. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is April the 11th, 1983. And for that, I am very grateful to everyone of you. Because every one of you played a part in that. Because it's everyone at this conference has given me the life that I have today. And I will always be grateful for that. And I want to tell you just a little bit about the drinking, because I want you to know that I am a true, real alcoholic. And the pain that I went through to get there, to get here. And this is one place that I would never imagine that I would be. Especially up here in front of you, telling you my story. But I was born to a family that didn't drink. My parents didn't drink. We had a normal childhood. As far as my parents went, they tried to teach me well, do right. It was a little bit unusual, but for the most part, it was good. Now, my uncle loved to drink, and I loved to be around him because it always looked like he was having fun. And everybody liked to be around him. He was one of these that partied, and it wasn't a bar thing. It was at home, cookouts, stuff like that. And he lived out in the country, and I enjoyed the open air, the going out in the country and enjoying being around people and doing the things that they were doing. And it was mostly adults, and I was a child. But I remember watching them drink and the fun. And when I was 14, I remember being in the truck with him, and he gives me this beer and says, "I think you're old enough to drink now." You know, and what came to, and I mean, this was the exact feeling that I had. I have arrived. That one statement in the big book that Bill made about he felt that he had arrived, I could relate to. And that was the start of it. I could drink with them then and have the fun. And it was fun in the beginning. But, you know, and as growing up, it was the weekends and stuff like that. And no real consequences. you know, a little bit here and there, but nothing major. And then, you know, that went on for a lot of years. But then the drinking started to progress, and I started to drink and have more consequences. And I finally became what I call a habitual DUI receiver. And this was my thinking. Well, I thought it was normal, and everybody got a DUI over the Christmas holidays every year. Because I did, and my friends did. And that worked out okay. You know, it was get a DUI, go to jail, get out. Drink some more. But what happened in the Christmas holidays of 1982, I went before the judge, and I always went before the same judge for years. And he said, you know, I'm really tired of seeing you. So if I ever see you in my court again for a DUI, you're going to do some jail time. And, you know, I really had to think about that. That one thing stuck in my head. And so, but, you know, just a few minutes later, I was drinking and starting to forget that. But it had been planted. That seed had been planted. And then in April, which was out of the ordinary, April the 1st, I got another DUI. That patrolman didn't know the system. You know, it's Christmas time. You don't do it in April. So, but I remembered what the judge said. And then on April the 11th, I got another DUI. The fear struck. And I remember sitting in the jail that time, no way out, no con left, no hope, totally empty inside. And I remember, and I have no idea where it came from, but I remember laying on that cold steel table in that jail cell, saying, God, I can't do this anymore. I'm tired. I can't do it. And at that moment, a guy came to the jail and said, do you want help? I didn't know what kind of help or anything else, but I wanted some relief. And I said, yeah. So he carried me to a treatment center. And this is the love that Alcoholics Anonymous has. He had been in the program for about 5 years. And on the way to the treatment center, he said, is it anything that you need? I said, I sure could use a beer right now. And he stopped and got me one. He walked in the store, came out with a beer. And this is how crazy I am. He walks out with a 16-ounce. And I said, I don't drink 16 ounces. I do 12 ounces. 16 ounces can get hot before you finish drinking it. You know, and we only had a block to go to the treatment center, and it was dry. But that was the start of something new for me. And the pain that I was going through there was brought on because of a divorce and all the stuff. Because a friend had asked me this week, said, what was the greatest pain in your life? Because I knew the subject for tonight, today. And I said, you know, my divorce from my first wife was absolutely the worst. And that's why I was drinking. That was 6 months before I went to treatment. And it was that my life was coming to an end. you know, because the divorce was something that should never happen. That's the way I was raised, that this was for life, that I was a failure. And all that pain, you know, I tried to drink away and I couldn't. And the part of going to treatment was exactly what I needed because of all that pain. And my wife and I did not want the divorce. Really didn't. We tried continuously to make things work, and it just wouldn't work. When I went into treatment, they had a family program. She went to it. And I got to know a little bit better about the things that I was doing and wanted that to work, but it didn't. You know, and I thought that when I got sober, everything would be okay. All the pain would go away. And at that time, things got better, but the pain didn't go away. And, you know, in sobriety, I've had pains that I've had to work through. And that's the greatest gift that I've had, is knowing that if I go through the pain, it's going to get a whole lot better. Because what I did while drinking was try to avoid the pain. And today I have something that I've never had before. I have a God that cares about me. That cares about me personally. I never knew that before. I missed school the day they told everybody else that. You know, and that's the joy that I have today. Is that I have a God that wants to give me every possible thing that I want. Not just what I need, but what I want. The only problem is I have to wait till I'm ready. You know, because I'm not always ready to receive. But He always wants to give to me. And I see that happening. All the time. Look, this is some of the joys that I've found because of going through the pain of all this. I've had to make amends, you know, to my son, because he was 4 years old at the time of the divorce. And, you know, I thought that I had done no harm to him. And then after I sober up and I think back and I say, well, what 4-year-old comes at you with a steak knife trying to stab you? So that you'll leave his mother alone and won't talk to her anymore. You know, I have a granddaughter now that's 12 years old. And this is some of the joy that I have, that God's given me, that I can see. She called me up, I guess last year, 2 years ago. She said, "Papa, you need to come spank my daddy." I said, "Baby, what are you talking about?" "My daddy said that you used to drink beer." This is a granddaughter that's never seen me drink. And this is the joy. You know, this is what it's all about. And I have a life today that I still have pain. I still have the pain. I had pain getting up here. It was so painful. The thing that came to my mind was a counselor that I had in treatment, and he was just like me. He was totally terrified of. I had problems talking one-on-one to people. And I asked him, I said, "Jimmy, they've asked me to speak in front of these people in treatment. What do I do?" He said, "The very first thing you do is put on some black pants and a pair of boots. And then if things get wet, nobody will know it, but you'll have a warm feeling all over it."
I
and I had to bring that with me today. But I've grown because I don't have to wear the black pants, but I did bring them just in case. And you know, that's what God's given me. It's the grand things that I don't even know, and I don't even know how this picture is going to play out. But I just keep putting the pieces of the puzzle together each day with God's help and with your help. And somewhere along the line, I'm able to see what the picture is beginning to look like. And for that, I'm very grateful. You know, this is what the program has given me, and this is the greatest joy. And one of the things, because this is where God working in my life and I can see the things, is my brother was an alcoholic. He said so. But he kept drinking. He called me one Saturday night so drunk that I couldn't even hardly understand him. My initial thing was to say, look, you're not making any sense. I can't half understand you. Go to sleep, pass out, call me tomorrow. And you know, the thing about it is I didn't. I sat there and listened. And you know, that was God working. Because a week later he died in a car wreck. That was the last time that I got to speak with him. What if I had done what I wanted to do and said, I don't want to talk to you. You know, this is what God's opened up for me. And this is the life that I'm able to have today. And in closing, you know, the thing that I've learned through everyone here, the treatment center, my ex-wife, all the pain that I've gone through, is that this simple program, all I have to do is to seek God. I don't have to chase Him. I don't have to hide from Him anymore. All I have to do is to seek Him. And He has all the blessings that He wants to give every one of us. And that is the one thing that I know without fail. It doesn't matter about anything else. If I do the seeking, He's going to do the giving. And I don't have to control people and try to change everything. And you know, in closing, I just want to thank every one of you for giving me this opportunity. This is my very first international conference. And you know, the one thing that I know for sure is I've missed a whole lot of good times in the past. But I don't plan to miss any more. Thank you for letting me share with you.
Man, that was pretty powerful. Three powerful messages. Thank you very much, all three of you. I don't know about you people, but I certainly identified with a lot of the pain that each one of these three individuals explained to us through their message of sharing. The program of AA is a gift, and you know, we're part of the chosen few. So thank you very much for your great message. That's about all. In